is an interview for the Shoe Workers Oral History Project at the Museum LA. The date is June 19th, 2009. This is Andrea Lungier, and I'm here with John Allard at the museum. John, could you start just by giving me your full name?
My name is John Allard.
And where and when were you born?
I was born in Brunswick, Maine.
And your date of birth?
December 31st, 51.
Oh, you were a New Year's baby.
Yes. No, not New Year's, New Year's Eve.
New Year's Eve,
right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow. And did you grow up in Brunswick?
No, I only lived there for as a baby, you know. And my parents moved to Lewiston and remained in Lewiston for most of my life.
Okay. And what were your parents' names?
My father's name was Antonio Allard, and my mother's name was Rose Anna Allard.
And did you have any brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have three sisters.
And what part of Lewiston did you grow up in?
The lower part of Lewiston, Lincoln Street, right in the city area.
Okay. And what did your parents do for work?
My mother was a stay-at-home mom, taking care of the kids, and my father was a mechanic.
So how did you come to go into shoe work?
I needed a job. I had quit school, and I was looking for work, and my sister got me a job at Cost Shoe.
Was she working there?
Yes, she was. She was working there, and she got me a job tack pulling. So that's how I started.
Oh, wow. And what age was that, about 16?
I lied about my age. I was actually 15.
Oh, yeah. And they weren't as strict on following up with age limits at that time, or did they just need workers? Do you have a sense of how you slipped by?
No, I think it's just plainly when you do this that they don't really look at it.
Right. You know. So your first job was at Cost Shoe. And how long did you stay there?
Oh, I was only there for a couple of months. And then I got a job someplace else. Again, I lied about my age later. I got a job. Actually, I got a job at different places. It wasn't a shoe factory. It was like a Cottle's supermarket. And then when I left there, I went to work at Lounge Shoe. They wanted you to be 17 years of age. I lied about my age again. I was actually 16. So.
And did you do different work there?
Over there, I did maintenance, all around helping, doing different things.
And so you went from shoe shop to shoe shop in the early years. Was that because you would get better money in different places, or what was your reason for moving?
Well, I went to work at Eastland Leather, which the owner owned Eastland Leather and also Main Stamping. Okay, and I went to work over there. I needed a job, and the boss's name was Junior Lemire, and I told him, I said, I really need a job, and he put me doing laminating. And then when I got used to that job, then he put me on hand cutting with a mallet. And when I got to be 18 years of age, he says, you're going to go on the machine now. I didn't want to go on the machine, but because I enjoyed with the mallet, you know, just hitting the die with the mallet. And he told me, he says, no, you're 18, you're going to go on the machine. So I did. Getting paid just about minimum wage. And then a friend of mine told me that they were hiring at Falcon Shoe Cutters. I didn't know how to cut shoes. But I said, well, I'll go over there. And I said, well, I'm willing to learn. And so they talked to me and said, okay, we'll teach you. And if you can make it, you can make it. If you can't, you can't. So I saw that I had potential. And I was fast, so they kept me. And Then that Falcon shoe, probably 4 times. I went back after quitting, went back, fired once, went back, and then quit and then again. So I worked there 4 times. I've just recently been laid off from there again, you know?
Yeah.
And so I could say that I spent most of my life working at Falcon Shoe as a shoe cutter, and I also became a leather assessor.
Leather what?
Assessor.
Okay.
That's taking care of the whole thing. And,
making sure of quality?
Making sure the quality of the leather, as well as the cutability. Mm-hmm. And also the inventory that's taken there, you know, so that you have enough leather to manufacture all the shoes.
So you quit and came back, and so what led you to keep going back to Falcon? Because it was one of the few places left, or?
Yes and no. I came back because I was used to cutting children's shoes, okay, and I enjoyed cutting children's shoes. And that was the first reason. But then, yes, because there was very few places left. Later on, that's the reason why I came back. And I was also familiar grounds, you know. When you're used to something, you know, it's kind of, you know, you hate change.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Now, in terms of the owner of Falcon Shoe and the management,
yep.
Did that change over the years, or was it fairly constant?
That's changed. The owner, the original owner, was Ted Johansson, which I admire very much. He was a very good man and very fair, you know. And I worked right underneath him as a leather assessor because that was his, what he called his baby, you know, that certain job, okay. So everything came right straight from him to me, you know, so that even though I had a foreman that was my boss, Ted had the last word. So if I wasn't sure of something, I went straight to Ted. And Ted was very reasonable and just told me, do this. And I did it, and that was it. You know, no matter what management would say, you know.
What year was it, or what time period was it, that you saw the shoe shops declining and something was really changing with the industry?
I would say the real time that was really, really changing was about 1980. I think, you know, it had been changing all along, but it really drastically changed around 1980. That's when I saw shoe shops just dropping out real quickly. And that was too bad because all manufacturing now is gone. I mean, if there is manufacturing, there's like still Falcon Shoe that's open. And there's places where they make shoes that are more expensive, that somebody's willing to pay a lot of money for. And those places are still surviving, but there's also greed in that, where, you know, why can't we go overseas and have it done and still sell it for a big amount, you know? So those are leaving too.
Tell me about what it was like growing up in Lewiston. And you were in the Lincoln Street area.
Right.
And this was in the 1960,
I'd say, around that.
Yeah.
It was kind of nice. It's not like today. Back then, you had a lot more to do. The fire department on Lincoln Street used to, there was a little park there, which had a swimming pool, and all sorts of accessories for the park. And in the winter time, they would water down the inside of the park and make a skating rink out of it, you know. And they even gave secondhand skates to the children that didn't have skates so that they could go ahead and skate, you know. And, you know, it's just basically we had a lot to do. It's not like today where kids have video games and they stay on the TV all the time,
yeah.
You know.
So you had, there were a lot of kids in the neighborhood. It was a go outside and play.
A lot of kids. If you had friends, you had, oh, maybe 40, 50 friends. You know, I mean, it's all sorts of friends to hang out with. And everybody went out to play, you know. And they weren't kicked out to play. They were anxious to get out to play, you know.
And at that time, the mills were still going.
Yes.
And so you had probably your friends or neighbors, some of them worked in the mills, being in the Lincoln Street area.
Yeah. So. Yeah, my parents were not in the mills or the shoe shops. But my friends, their fathers, even their mothers, had worked in the mills and the shoe shops. And most of Lincoln Street and lower Lisbon Street and different places around here, like Park Street and stuff like that. All these people all worked in the mills, and you could see them walking to work. And it was like traffic going on the sidewalks, walking to the mill, you know. And I remember seeing them come out of Bates Mill even. They used to have this little cabin, which was a watchman right there. And you see the little bridge going across the canal and see all the people crossing, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people, you know. And just that man that was in the little cabin would just wave to him, have a nice day, and, you know. And it was a community. It was people that all worked together and knew each other.
And your family, did they shop on Lisbon Street a lot? Where were the food stores? Did you have a car? How did that work?
We had a car, and we used to go to, there was a place called Butcher Boys, which was a place where you could buy horse meat. And back then, I mean, you know, it was cheaper, so we used to eat whatever we could, you know, get for cheap. There was a First National store. There was Samson's food store. My mother was one to look for bargains, so she used to drag my father around to save a couple of pennies at that place and a couple of pennies at the other place, and, you know, do the groceries that way.
And was the department stores still open on Lisbon Street at that time?
Yes, the department stores were all open at the time. And it was, I think, comparing to today, it was very enjoyable. It wasn't as fast to go in and out, but it was enjoyable to do it, because especially at Christmas time, they would decorate the whole street, and you could go from one store, go to the next door, to the next door, to the next door, similar to a mall, but you go outside instead of inside. And there was Kresge's, Woolworths, there was Ward Brothers, there was a lot of places, you know. And you would do your shopping, picking up a little something here, a little something there. And it just made Christmas and shopping so much more enjoyable that you'd like doing it. And being a male, well, males don't like to shop. But I did like that, you know.
In terms of the shoe industry, and you said currently you're laid off, do you see yourself going back and working again?
In the shoe shop?
Yeah.
I've been going back to Falcon Shoe at least once a month to speak to them to see if anything's happening, and they're calling us back. You know. And I don't know if anything's going to happen, you know, whether it's going to stay small like that or eventually just disappear. Mm-hmm. Currently, right now, I'm working for the school department as a sub for a janitor. And put in a proposal to go full-time. So I'm waiting for results from that. And when I get results from that, I believe in a couple of weeks I'll be working full-time for them.
And talk to me about shoe cutting.
Shoe cutting?
In terms of the details of what your work entailed. What was it that you learned that you were good at?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing, and shoe cutting is one thing. Leather assessing is another thing, okay? Leather assessing, actually helped me out because of getting to know what the hide looks like and why it's like that and the reasons why there's imperfections. Shoe cutting is a trade, and it's not just a job, it's a trade. And a hide, steer hide, okay, it is just like your very own skin, okay? Your skin is tight at some places, and some places it's not. So where you put that part of the skin in the, what we call a dye, which cuts out the pieces for the shoes, has to be a certain strength. You know, on the top of your foot, it would have to be very strong because your foot bends, and because it's bending, it's plying that that leather. And in the plying of the leather, it weakens it. So if you've got a weak piece of leather, your shoes are not going to look very good. Okay, and if you've got a tough piece of leather, it'll look good for a lot longer until, you know, sure, of course, everything wears out. But, and there's the back side of the shoe, on the left and the right, which we call quarters. The reason why we call them quarters is because there's four of them. There's two on each foot, okay? And those pieces go from your heel towards the front of the foot, you know, and that part has to be so. I mean, you know, it doesn't have to be perfect, but it has to be strong. And you have, of course, your tongue of your shoe, which that don't matter too much because that's just going to be a tongue and laces on top of it. You've got other parts like backstays, foxings, depending on type of shoe that you have. You may have split vamps. You may have a vamp with a tip. Okay, the styles that they had. Some styles had only 8 pieces to the shoe. Some had 22 pieces to the shoe, you know, depending on what the look would be. And every piece had to be a certain thickness and strength. So that the wear and tear of the shoe would be, the quality of the shoe. You know.
So what were some of the hard parts about cutting shoes?
One, it was basically at the time, it was piecework, you know, which... in order to make good money, you had to be fast. So the more you cut, the more you made. Okay, so that was one thing. Another thing, it was not everybody can do it, because you have to be fast for one thing. You have to be able to cut clothes for another thing. You know, because leather is very expensive, and if you didn't save any leather, then it would cost the company a lot of money. So fortunately for me, I was very fast and also very close at saving leather. So I profited both ways. And I think that it's like doing a puzzle. Okay, it's not everybody that can do a puzzle, okay? So I was told when I was learning to cut shoes that maybe 1 out of 20 makes it, okay? And I think, I personally think, because the type of people that were working in the shoe factory, not to say that they couldn't teach, but I think I had a better way of teaching than they did. Because later on, when I had learned how to cut shoes, I would say 1 out of every 5 people would become shoe cutters with my training. While I was being trained, it was 1 out of 20.
Right.
Okay, because I have more patience, you know, And some people just don't have patience. So.
And so you say so many, you know, percentage don't make it. Does that mean they have tried to learn and have been working but can't meet quotas? Were there quotas? Or how did the dropout rate occur?
Well, it's kind of it's economics, okay? It's seeing if somebody's going to make it, well, the person's going to end up at the end of the job, having all his VAMPs cut, his quotas will be all cut, and everything's going to be all cut. But he's not going to say, well, I still have VAMPs to cut, okay, because that's a no-no. You have to have your lesser quality cuts left to cut before you still have to have some of those in the end. Your VAMPs have to be done first. That's one thing. Another thing is you're allowed so much leather. And if you come back and you say, well, I need some more, each foot of leather at that time, back when I started cut shows, was only $1.70 a foot. And $1.70 a foot, you go back and you get 30 feet. That's quite a bit of money. Especially for back then, because back then minimum wage was only $1.80. So that was like an hour's work just for one foot, you know. So that was one thing they looked at. And if the management saw that, you know, he came back for X amount of feet, well, we can't use him. Send him home, you know. So it was a quick turnaround, you know. Somebody got a job. Hope to keep it, and hope I can make it. You know, the ones that made it, well, they made good money, and the ones that didn't, well, they went home looking for a job. You know, and like I said, it's not a profession that everybody can do. You know,
I've heard the same thing from hand sewers.
Yes,
that it's really
yes.
It's not a job; it's a trade.
Yep.
You really learn it, and
yep.
There's a natural piece to it.
Yep. I've done hand sewing. I tried it out for, I believe, 3 months. I ended up getting a trigger finger. Okay, and I know they all have it. Okay, and it's not something that I would prefer to do. That's a trade, and it's a very hard trade. You know, it's cutting is more. In the art of cutting. Hand sewing is an art too, but it's more like you've got a pattern to do and you continue to repetitiously do it. But it's hard on your hands, very hard on your hands. And I wouldn't even want to attempt it anymore.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you that you think is important to talk about? In terms of the shoe industry and your recollections and observations?
The only thing I think is the way people feel about jobs going overseas.
Mm.
Seeing all these things going, that the United States is just going to be a big telemarketer, okay? And service jobs, okay, and even these service jobs are going to go someplace else, okay. What do we have? What will we have? Are we all going to be homeless or what? We're going to be helping all these other countries, but we won't even help ourselves, you know. That's kind of a sad thing because, you know, there's a lot of hardworking people, you know, in every culture. But here, just to talk about Louis and Robin, a lot of French people, you know. That never had a handout, okay? They've worked hard for what they got. And it's like somebody just came over and just said, okay, we've used you, you've done your part, and now we're going to give the job to somebody else. And kind of leaving you in the cold. And then you have the thing of, well, you got to go and find some more work. I'm doing something that I prefer not doing, you know, but I'm learning to do it, because I'm not a house cleaner, you know what I mean? And what am I doing? Washing floors, sweeping, dusting, all this kind of stuff, you know? It's not what I'd like to do, it's what I have to do to survive. And to me, it's degrading, okay? Because when you have a trade, like my father was a mechanic. I mean, he was a mechanic, you know, and that's it, you know? He had a trade. And I had a trade as a shoe cutter. But now it's like you're almost like living in Russia, where you're told what kind of job you're going to have. Basically, it's like that because you're not told, but you have to. You know, you can't pick and choose. And at my age, I'm really not very keen with the computer. And even in applying for a job today, things have changed. You got to do it by computer, which I find that that's not right. Okay, there should be a written application as well. You know, and right now I'm thinking I'm also trying to put that in place where there's maybe there'll be a law written, you know, against that because it's prejudice. You know, and it's prejudice against age. You know, because younger kids taught how to use a computer. Somebody my age was not taught. And neither do I want to learn, to be honest with you, you know? So I think that it's not only losing the culture, but losing a way of life, you know, where you can't really do what you want to do, you know? You can become something if you've, one, you've got money, two, you come from a rich family where daddy's going to take care of you, or you go to college and you learn something that you can get into, you know. And like I said, at my age, by the time I get out of college, I'd be retired. So why would I want to get into something? So that's what I see is happening.
One last question. I was thinking about the social aspects of working in the shoe shops. Did you build and maintain friendships from the shoe shops? Were you working with people in a way that promoted that, you know, going out to do something together after work, that sort of thing? Or were you by yourself?
The social part was kind of nice. Away from home, you had your friends. You had people to socialize with and stuff. And yes, sometimes after work, we'd go and do something, you know, whether it was, most of the time it was somebody going to the bar and have a few beers, you know. And yes, I got to admit, it was a lot of alcoholics.
Yeah.
but sometimes it was something to do with somebody wanted to go bowling or something like that, you know, some activities, you know.
I know there were quite a few private membership social clubs,
right,
on Lisbon Street.
Yeah.
Are any of those still there that you were familiar with at the time?
No.
Or I know there's like the Acme Club.
Yeah, there was the Acme. I never belonged to the Acme, and but I did know somebody that belonged there. Most of those clubs are now gone. The one that most people from Falcon Shoe would go to is called the LMA Bowlers Club, which was on Lincoln Street. And because it was just a few minutes away from Falcon Shoe, that you could actually go there at noontime, have a couple of beers, run back to work, and try to get back on time. You know?
And that was called the what? The Alanay?
Alanay Bowlers Club.
Bowlers Club.
Yep. Yeah. And everybody seemed to have congregated around there.
Yeah.
You know.
So there were, I'm sort of getting a sense of what it looks like now and back then in the 70s and the 80s. It was, had a lot more of these clubs on Lisbon Street and Lincoln Street and that area.
Yes, yes. And if you date back and look at anything to do with that, there was a place that was on Lisbon Street called Blanche Turcotte. It was an ice cream shop next to the pawn shop. Okay, these two older ladies that were working in there, I remember as a kid going in there and having an ice cream, would tell me stories about Lisbon Street and the mills and stuff. And they would tell me about, I think it was Blanche, her name. She and her husband moved to Lewiston from New York. Brought their marble bar with all their ice cream and everything else, and their little tables and stuff, and they started an ice cream shop before the bars were on Lisbon Street, when it was a nice little community where everybody went to church and they went for an ice cream on Sunday and stuff like that. And but then she says the bars showed up, and one bar and then two bars and three, and then the whole street was bars after a while, which kind of brought down her business, and the social life wasn't the same, you know. It became very rough. And
did it?
Yes,
yeah.
It became very rough, and you had people from out of town going there, and there was a lot of fights, and I actually lived in a building which now is Country Kitchen, which is right across the street from my house was a beer joint that was called Red Rail. And every Friday and Saturday nights, me and my sister used to look down and place bets on who was going to win the fight. You know, a couple of drunks coming out of there, and they don't even know how to swing, and they're just flying all over the place, you know. So that was kind of entertainment that was.
Wow, yeah, and then they just sort of, did they start fading away, the multitude of bars, as the mills and the shoe shops dissipated, went away?
Well, yes, it did, but it wasn't because of that.
Oh.
It was because the city was giving out less permits for bars and stuff, trying to clean up Lisbon Street.
Okay.
And I think they've tried to clean up Lisbon Street, but it's not going to be like it used to be, because today we've got big malls, and even the malls that we have, those are going to disappear, because there's a Walmart, and sooner or later there'll be bigger people than the Walmart, until you only have one store to go to, you know, which is a monopoly, and that takes away, again, the enjoyment of shopping, you know. Like I said, men don't like to shop. Women love to shop. I know, because I used to own a pet shop, and I used to have women coming in to the pet shop, and I'd say in my mind behind the counter, oh, I'm going to make some money, and see them walking out empty-handed. Only I found out that they came back in a month or so and bought. They're window shopping, you know, and that's something that I've learned, and I wouldn't have learned unless I opened up my own shop.
Well, great. Thank you so much.
Okay.